for this morning, just call him Bill, a man whom I first met while he and I were both still teenagers. He, at that time and thereafter, declared himself to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And from my observation and interaction with him, there was, to me, no reason at all to doubt either his Christian testimony or his Christian commitment. I think one of the things that most impressed me about him was the many gifts that God had bestowed upon him. He was truly talented, talented in ways that kind of awe me as I sit back and see that someone is able to do so much, and particularly to do so many of the things that I have no capability to do. Anyway, he used those gifts, went into training, graduated from a Bible college, married a classmate whom he met at that school, a woman of sterling character and just an outstanding wife for him. Together they sought God's will on what they ought to do with their lives and decided, I think really before they were even married, that God was calling them into missionary service. And so shortly after their marriage, they applied to a well-known missions organization. They were accepted. The underwriting of their support came, and they left to travel overseas. Traveled overseas, and there had, expectedly, a good and a significant ministry as foreign missionaries. It was there that they began to raise their family. It was there that their children had their initial growing up years and experience of life. It was there that they served God well. Until he stooped into some terrible, terrible aspects of a heartbreaking life of sin. Because of that, missionary service was ended. They came back to the United States. It was only a very, very short time after that that they were separated, divorced, their family divided, and it's a timeless story. A timeless story that, with one name or another, you've heard before. One that perhaps you can identify with because of your own family or because of your own friends. It's a story that's been told for centuries and millennia. The story of those who seemed to start so well and knew so much better, falling into great sin. Now, it's because it's such a timeless story that the 32nd chapter of Exodus is such a famous chapter and such a familiar chapter of the Bible. Because it has a message that we all need to hear, a message that we all need to understand. The message that redeemed people are not exempt from sin, nor its consequences. Throughout this chapter, already read this morning, there are three themes that are carefully, amazingly interwoven. And with those three themes are told the tale of golden sin out there in the Sinai Desert. The first of those themes in Exodus 32 speaks of the seriousness of sin and how it all began with impatience. Verse 1 says that when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, and then the story goes on. Remember that these people had spent 400 years in slavery. They and their predecessors in the Hebrew nation had been necessarily, but actually, extraordinarily patient waiting for God's doing. But here they couldn't wait 40 days and 40 nights for Moses to come down off of Mount Sinai. And so impatience became the preface to their sin, although we know that that is anything but uncommon. Impatience is often the preface to sin of a couple that doesn't want to wait until they're married, or of an employee who takes from the company till rather than waiting until the next paycheck comes along. Impatience then and impatience now is often the crack in the door that eventually is swung wide open to what the Bible here describes as great sin. But the root of their sin was not so much in their impatience. The root of their sin was in their misbelief about leadership. Verse 1 continues to say that the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, We do not know what has become of him. While it's true that Moses was the human leader of those people out of slavery, somehow they had misunderstood that the effectiveness of their escape and their redemption was tied up in Moses. They didn't understand that Moses was merely a human instrument who could readily be replaced, and they thought that everything hung on him. And it is because of their misplaced belief about leadership that they got into the trouble into which they came. That, too, is an oft-repeated story. The tragic misbelief that has gotten people into trouble, not only in ancient days, but modern days as well. You can see it even in the life of the church. Take a church where it seems that God is extraordinarily blessing, where no matter what measuring stick you use, you can see that God's hand is upon that fellowship of believers. You see that sinners are becoming saints. You see that people's problems are being resolved. You see that marriages are being reconciled. You see where missions just explodes and where growth skyrockets. And there's a sense of spirituality. And then the pastor dies or retires or receives a call to some other ministry. And the people misbelieve. They think that it's the human leadership. They think it's because of someone who sat in an office or at a board meeting or behind a pulpit that's why all happened that happened. And that misbelief concerning leadership becomes the basis for all kinds of theological heresy in terms of taking away from God the glory that is rightly his. Never, ever do spiritual things happen simply because of human leadership. As great a leader as Moses was, or as great leaders as God has ever provided anywhere in the economy of his dealing with people, it has always been God. God is the one who does it, and to give his glory, to think that he is dependent upon some human leader, borders on, in fact, indulges in blasphemy, because it gives God's glory to someone else. So what began with the preface of impatience became an incredible misbelief, in fact, I think, blasphemy against God as the seriousness of their sin developed. Now, the actual great sin that was acted out there in the Sinai desert was idolatry. Idolatry that was simple and stupid, as simple and stupid as it was sinful. Here, the story tells us that Aaron, the high priest-elect, called for offerings of gold, and that he took the earrings from the people and he melted them down and fashioned a gold bull. And then he put it up before Israel and told them that this hunk of gold shaped in the form of a bull was in fact the God that delivered them out of the captivity in Egypt. And then he went so far as to also construct on quick order an altar that was placed in front of this golden bull or calf. And he announced that there would be a great feast or festival in which they would bring their sacrifices and they would kill the sacrifices in worship and gratitude to this golden animal. You recall, of course, although perhaps Aaron didn't, that it was only a matter of days before that the Ten Commandments were given and all the people had stood before God and Moses and said, "Indeed, we will obey." How soon they had forgotten the words of the Lord that you shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above or in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. What's amazing is that they apparently did know that and were tricky enough to say that while we will break the second commandment against the graven image, we will be very, very careful not to break the first commandment about setting up other gods other than Yahweh, the God of Israel. Because when the golden calf was finished, and when the altar was built, Aaron called to all of the people and announced to them that there would be a feast. There would be a festival, but that it would be a feast or a festival, in verse 5, to the Lord. What they were guilty of was spiritual syncretism. What they were guilty of was not saying, we will have no more to do with Yahweh, but we will bring together the religion of the true God with the religion of the Egyptians and the Canaanites. So we won't turn against the Lord whom we have vowed our allegiance to, but we will bring in the other religions of the nations around us, and we will mix them together into a syncretism, a mixture together of religion. How little they understood God if they thought they could get away with that. For the scripture is clear, and they ought to have known, that God will not share his glory nor his worship with anyone or anything else. There could be no Egyptian religion with their bulls, their apis, and other gods, nor could there be Canaanite religion with all of the absurdities of human sacrifice and all the indignities that were part of the land of Canaan. God will not share his worship with anyone or anything. That was true for Jews in ancient times in the Middle East, but that's true for modern people as well. God doesn't buy into the syncretism where Christianity and Voodooism are mixed in Haiti. God doesn't buy into the syncretism where the gospel of Jesus Christ and communism are tried in some people's minds to be merged together behind the Iron Curtain. Any more than God gives approval to our mixing together the true gospel of Jesus Christ and the religion of Scripture with our materialism of America. God is patently clear that faithfulness to him requires an exclusive relationship, and that idolatry is not only building the graven images, but trying to mix the religion of the graven images together with the true religion that acknowledges him and acknowledges him alone as the Lord of our lives. Well, the sinning tragically did not end with idolatry. Because that day in the desert of Sinai, idolatry led to immorality. It's a little bit hidden in verse 6, but actually it's there. Exodus 32:6 says that they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. In the translation from Hebrew into English, the translators have been careful to be discreet in their choice of words. What they here have not told to us is that the wording here refers not to playing games in the sense of sports, but playing games in the sense of sex. In fact, later on in the chapter, that becomes even more evident when it is explained the shame that their behavior has caused even before the pagan nations that surround them. As part of their idolatry, they not only ate and drank, and of course there's no fault particularly to be found with that in its absolute sense, but after eating and drinking, the next morning they engaged in something of a national sex orgy. And so what began as idolatry and the breaking of one commandment spiraled out until it was sexual immorality and the breaking of other commandments. There's something kind of interesting to all of this, an interesting insight into sexual immorality. I think that most often we think that sexual immorality begins with lust, and that when we lust, that we have started a whole mechanism that eventually ends up in the actual consummation of illicit sex. Apparently from Scripture, we are here being taught that it is not always that way. Rather, that oft-times, sexual immorality begins with the breaking of the commandment concerning worship and concerning God. And when God is no longer first and foremost in our lives, and when we have replaced him as the Lord of our lives, then we have opened the door to other sins to come in, and immorality follows as part of the flood, rather than that which initially opens the gate. When Moses came down off that mountain and he saw all of this, he had an amazing mixture of emotions that was heartbreak and anger. He immediately went to the man whom he perceived to be the primary character responsible for the great sin in which the people of Israel had indulged, and that was his own brother, Aaron. So we are told in verse 21 that he went to Aaron and confronted him and said, "Aaron, what did this people do to you?" That was kind of gracious of him to at least move a little bit of the blame over. "What did this people do to you that you have brought a great sin?" Isn't it interesting that the adjective is again and again used, "a great sin upon them?" Aaron then tried to wiggle out of it with a series of rationalizations. First, he blamed others. So Aaron said, "Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil." He did, I confess to you, exactly what I do when caught unexpectedly in a trap of my own failure and my own sin. I immediately want to think of someone else whose fault it is, so that I can quickly point a finger and get all of the attention that is making me blush away from me and over to someone else. I may be willing to admit at least partial guilt, but it's primarily because someone else is evil, and it's primarily because of what someone else said or did. How reluctant I am, how reluctant you are, to take the blame ourselves, particularly if a great sin is involved. Not only did he blame others, but then he decided to absolutely let his imagination rule in what has got to be one of the funnier verses of Exodus. Chapter 32, verse 24, quotes Aaron as saying, "I threw the gold into the fire, and there came out a calf." Now, this guy is really into believing stuff that I find to be absurd. That's ridiculous. Somehow, I guess he figured that Moses was into the supernatural, and maybe he would believe this. Who knows? And if he believes it, then he's off the hook. But aren't we often the same way when we sin? Don't we, in fact, let our imaginations roll until we stoop to blame that which is absolutely absurd in order to somehow rationalize our iniquity? I mean, really, in 1986, isn't that kind of what we do when getting involved in an extramarital affair and we say, well, the reason is because of midlife crisis? Or when we rationalize the unkind words that we speak to someone else, and when caught, perhaps confronted by some fellow Christian who says, you know, what you are saying really hurts deeply another believer in Jesus Christ. And we come back and say, yes, but it's the truth. It's the truth. As if that is some sort of rationale and explanation for doing that which the Bible so clearly forbids. Or when we as parents face up painfully to our failures in parenting, the things we never should have said, the things we never should have done, and more than that, the things we should have said and the things that we should have done. And when we see the impact of our own sins repeated in the lives of our children, and we come back and say, well, you know, it's not my fault, it's because of the schools. The schools these days are just terrible. And it's the neighborhood in which we lived, it's the influence of the other kids, and it's the church failed. You know, it's some youth pastor, someone in a Sunday school class, and we stoop to the same kind of rationalization that characterized not just Aaron and us, but has characterized sinners in every place throughout all of time. How reluctant we are to face up to the theme of Exodus 32 and the seriousness of sin. You see, sin is something like a bullet that comes into the head, penetrates the skull, and just ricochets around the skull until we are senseless and torn apart and destroyed. Let us never underestimate, let us never minimize the seriousness, the horror of sin. There's a next theme, a second one, also woven into this famous 32nd chapter of Exodus. It is the theme of the certainty of the consequences of serious sin. Sin has certain consequences, and there is nothing greater than the way it changes our relationship to God. Look at a couple of verses. Verse 7 says that the Lord told Moses, "Go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt." In verse 9, the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them." I understand this use of pronouns, because in our house, occasionally, I say to Charlene, "Do you know what your son or your daughter said or did?" That is seldom an indication of something good. That is usually an indication of real trouble coming up on the western horizon, because I don't want to take responsibility. I'm distancing myself. And so God is apparently distancing himself from these his chosen people. He says to Moses, "Your people, this people, this next people." No longer is he saying, "My people, my beloved people, my Israel, my children." No longer is he speaking words of love and affirmation and support. God recognizes that they have turned against him, that they've broken his commandments, they've rejected his love. And while the relationship is not broken, the relationship is undoubtedly changed. I doubt that we think of that in advance when we sin. I know that I don't. I think of sin, and I think of most of the things that I do, in terms of me and how it will impact my everyday life and how it will impact the way I feel and the way I function. We're so self-centered in our sinfulness that we forget that when we sin, that impacts God. That God is the one who is most deeply hurt. That our sin breaks his heart. That God is extraordinarily sensitive to sin, far more than anyone else around us. And so when we see the impact of sin in our own lives and in the lives of other people about us, that is but a fraction of what it does to the heart and the life of God, who is so much more attuned to the reality and the consequences of iniquity. The relationship, it changes. And I wonder if in the camp of Israel, those hundreds of thousands of people, I wonder if that next day they could feel the difference. Oh, not that the temperature out in the desert was any cooler, but I suspect at least that they could feel it, that there was a hollowness and emptiness in their heart, that as they did the routine things, whether it was drawing water or gathering manna, whether it was trying to pray or to discipline a child or to make love within a marriage, I wonder if in fact they did not sense that there was some barrier that had come, and that things were no longer as they were before, that the relationship with God had changed, they had turned against him. Now things were different. Not only was there a changed relationship as a consequence of that serious sin, but also in verses 15 to 20 we have that for which this chapter is even better known, the breaking of the covenant. As we've studied here all of these Sunday mornings through Exodus, you can't help, I hope, but realize that the covenant was central to all that the story is about. This special contractual relationship, covenant relationship between Yahweh and Israel. A mutual commitment, although clearly initiated by God. A mutual commitment to one another, a mutual contract that, as we have learned, was best understood in terms of redemption and commandments. They were redeemed from slavery in Egypt, and they were given the commandment so that they could live as a redeemed people. When Moses came down off that mountain, which we think of in terms of the Cecil B. DeMille movie about the Ten Commandments, when Moses came down off that mountain, he had in his hand tablets or stones, two of them that were identical, interestingly, not five commandments on one and five commandments on the other, but written on both sides and each a complete set, because that was typical of covenants that were made in ancient times. One part of the covenant, one statement of the covenant was given to one partner, and the other statement of the covenant was given to the other partner. So God had prepared two statements of the Ten Commandments. And they had been, we are told, actually etched by the finger of God upon that stone. I mean, think of that in terms of its spiritual, even its archaeological significance. Here was something that God himself had not only generated, but that God himself in his own hand had written. And Moses is carrying them down off the mountain, and he looks and sees what has happened. And he sees the horror of the sin. He sees the golden calf. He can smell the smoke that's going up from the altar. He sees the people dancing. It's just such an obvious transgression. The covenant has been broken. And so that which had been broken spiritually, Moses took and smashed at the foot of the mountain, and he broke physically. All that really was a symbolic representation of what had already happened. How tragic. I mean, these people had a covenant with God himself. And it was still new and fresh and already broken. Well, the consequences of sin are not just spiritual consequences. They often also are tangible consequences. There was so much unnecessary suffering. In verses 25 to 29, we are told that Moses asked who would stand with the Lord. And they were Levites, one of the 13 tribes of Israel. And so it was ordered that they would go out and that they would kill, actually with the sword, kill people in the camp of Israel. And so there were 3,000 men, 3,000 Jews who died that day. We're not told here in Exodus 32 why those particular 3,000 were chosen and others were allowed to live. Apparently those were the ones who most integrally were involved in this particular sin, and God in his wisdom chose them. And then in addition to the execution of the 3,000, at the very end of the chapter, we're told that God even sent a plague so that those people were physically afflicted, a direct punishment for their sins. Not because God takes delight ever in inflicting suffering, but because God wanted to deeply impress upon those people that they were never, never, never to so sin again. You know what good it did? Very little. We're comparatively early in Exodus in the Old Testament. When you page through its chapters, you will find again and again and again that the people of Israel stoop to idolatry. King after king, prophet after prophet, generation after generation, idolatry after idolatry, until in the 6th century B.C., God allowed a foreign power to come in and to take what was left of the nation of Israel and take it away for 70 years into a land where idolatry was the norm. And once and for all, Jews were cured of idolatry. And while there may be an extensive list of sins which we can indict Jews and Gentiles alike for, one sin that you will not indict a Jew now or any time after the exile for is idolatry. Finally, the lesson was learned, but not here in Exodus 32. Well, so much for the theme of the seriousness of sin and the certainty of the consequences. Actually, I think it's kind of unfortunate that Exodus 32 is best known for its sin. I'll tell you, it really ought to be best known for its prayer. I find that this chapter is a great chapter of encouragement for parents who are concerned about the waywardness of their children. It's a great chapter for husbands and wives who are concerned about sin in the life of a spouse. It's a great chapter for those who are concerned about their nation and want to pray that it be a nation that turns to God. For herein is the account of the man of God influencing the lives of others through intercession, through prayer. First, Moses uses logic when he intercedes. And so verses 11 to 14 tell Moses' prayer. And he goes to God and he says, Lord, why would you destroy those that you just saved? Good question, isn't it? Lord, what would your reputation be like amongst the Egyptians if you brought all these people out of captivity and then they all died out in the wilderness? Lord, what about the promises that you made to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Israel? And so Moses prayed with the logic of who God was and what he had committed. Verse 14 says that the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do to his people. Let me give you a quick theology lesson here. This is not to say that God is a fickle God. He decides to go one way and then, because of the logic of some mortal, changes his direction. This is what the theologians call anthropopathism, coming from two Greek words, anthropos, which we get anthropology, which means man, and pathos, which is the word for emotion or feeling. What we have here is that human emotions and human ways of repenting and doing things are being used to describe the behavior and the revelation of God. God, to be sure, is omniscient, and God knew before the creation of the world all that would happen, including the prayer that Moses would pray. But understand that God also, in his wisdom and in his economy of doing things, chose deliberately that intercessory prayer would make a difference in people's lives and would make a difference in the course of history. God is the one who chose that intercessory prayer would be a means to his ultimate end. So Moses prays his first prayer, It's a prayer of logic. And I like that. But I like even better his prayer in verses 30 to 34, because that's the prayer of life. He moves from logic to life, so much so that he offers his own life in exchange for the Hebrew people. God has said, Moses, I'm going to kill them all and let you live. Moses, I'm going to raise up a great nation out of you. And Moses gets down on his knees and says, no, God, no, not that they die and I live. Let me die and let them live. Not that I'm saved and they're lost. May it be, God, that I'm lost and they're saved. And I'll tell you, God doesn't feel that way. Only once has he allowed for there to be such a substitution in all of history, and that being when Jesus died on the cross for us. But the point here is Moses' zeal and earnestness. He was willing to die so that those whom he loved could live, and they were the sinners. He's willing to surrender his own salvation so that others may be saved. It's the kind of unselfish intercessory prayer that moves the heart and moves the hand of God. Now, Moses isn't the only one. You pick up the books of history, you'll find that there was a woman in the 3rd century named Monica who had a son who was a sinner of the first order. She prayed patiently and diligently and self-sacrificially. She prayed with logic and life the way Moses did, desperately for her son, and she saw seemingly no response or change of heart. But she wouldn't quit praying until her son Augustine became perhaps one of the greatest leaders of the Christian church in all of history, and is known to us as St. Augustine. Well, in the 18th century, there was a man named George Mueller. George Mueller, who was a great man of God, but also a great philanthropist as well. He prayed for over 70 years every day of his life for the salvation of a friend, and he died, and that friend was still not a Christian. But between the day when George Mueller died and the day George Mueller was buried, his friend came to a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And I'll tell you something better yet, that intercessory prayer is not limited to Moses or Monica or Mueller. That intercessory prayer is for us, for my life, and for this church. I've seen it. I've seen it in my own life, and I've seen it in my own family, and I have seen it in my own church. That people who pray passionately with logic and with life, people who are sold out to God and unselfishly intercede before others, are those that yet move the heart and the hand of God. Now, time's gone, but I'm concerned that this just be an academic exercise, and that's far from what God ever intended to be. So I think we ought to do what is here recommended, and that is to pray. Would you bow your head with me for just a brief time of private prayer? And let me ask you two questions. First, what is your sin of which you know better? What is the sin which stands between you and the right relationship with God? And right now, confess that sin and tell God you'll quit. And the second question is, who is the one for whom you ought to pray? Whose life going down the tube of sin? Who is it that needs the direct intervention of God himself? Right now and later as well. Intercede for that person. Lord, may the themes of the ancient chapter of Scripture be the themes of our life as well. May we acknowledge the seriousness of sin and the certainty of sin's consequences. But may we also be men and women of intercession to claim the power of prayer which you have entrusted to us through Jesus Christ.